Hello and welcome to the All Terrain Podcast, brought to you by the Youth and Children's Ministry Unit of the Salvation Army in the United Kingdom and Ireland Territory. My name is Matt White, and in each episode, I'll be inviting a guest to take a hypothetical hike with me as we find out about their real life journey to this point. Along the way, they'll make four choices and answer four questions. In this episode, our guest is Major Helen Schofield. Helen is the Territorial Youth and Children's Secretary for the United Kingdom and Ireland Territory. That's the same group of people, the same unit, who create this whole podcast. So Helen is the boss. I'm interviewing the boss today. But Helen's also a dear friend of mine, and we've known each other for many, many years. And I honestly cannot wait for you to hear everything that she brings to this episode. Hi, Helen. Welcome to the All Terrain Podcast.
Hi, Matt. Great to see you.
Hello. And I say welcome. I mean, it's your podcast, really. I mean, it's from the Youth and Children's Ministry Unit, and you're the boss. So welcome to your own podcast, I should say.
Wow, thanks. Yes, it's a pleasure to be here, even though I'm the boss. It's a joy, I think, to be part of it.
Now, I've been trying to get you on this podcast from basically episode one. I have been saying since episode one, I want Helen on the podcast. And it's taken me almost 30 episodes, well, over 30 episodes, because whilst this is technically episode 30, we have a couple of specials hidden in there as well. So it's over 30 episodes to get you on. So I'm very excited to have you on the All Terrain Podcast. I'm really excited. We've known each other a long time.
Yeah, we have. I don't know actually how many years. It's got to be at least probably 15, would you say?
I think so. So I started working for the Salvation Army in 2003.
And I became a DY in 2007.
Okay.
DYO. So probably from that point, I'm guessing.
Yeah, between 15 and 20 years. Wowza, that is a long time. And obviously,
getting on a bit that.
don't. I feel it. Now, you mentioned you were DYO. You're currently the Territorial Secretary. You've been a Division Youth Officer as well. What other appointments have you held as an officer? I was thinking about this the other day, and I don't think I know. So what else have you done in your officership?
Okay, so when I came out of the training college, I was appointed to Bristol. So I was based at a corps called Bristol South, but also associate officer to Bristol Citadel. So corps officership, that was a crazy, crazy, wonderful 5 years. Tough communities, very distinct communities. Bristol South is on an outer city council estate. Real depth of poverty there. They sit in the top percent, top 10%, or they did, of urban deprivation. And Bristol Citadel at that point sat very much in the red light district in Bristol. So Bristol, I was at Western Super Mare as corps officer again for a short while, and then DY, and then in between being a DY and coming into this post, I served in the candidates unit as the deputy candidates director. So quite a variety of appointments, really. Quite different.
Really interesting. Really interesting variety. And you've been in this role for a few years now, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. It'll be 6 years in the summer. So, yes.
We've all lost two. So all time sort of stopped, didn't it? And it's like, where did that go? But 6 years in the summer. Wow, that's amazing. And outside then of your officership, of your kind of your roles and all of that, what do you like to do? What fills your kind of spare time?
My spare time is probably filled with friends, really. I love I've got a beautiful network of friends, and I've got, you know, a lovely family as well, but they're up in Nottingham. Just going out walking. I'm passionate about walking, being in the countryside, but meeting up, sharing good food. That's probably that fills my tank. I love to read, but I don't always remember. I read too quickly, so I don't remember what I've read, which isn't helpful. But probably just the relational thing for me. That's a big thing. And the beauty of when we couldn't do that, obviously in lockdown, we couldn't meet our friends, but we could go out to walk. I really benefited from just getting outside.
Now, we'll get on to the questions in a minute. But of course, before we start, we have to make our first two choices. So you've said you love to walk and you love to be out and about. So on this hypothetical hike, where are we walking?
Okay, I've gave some thought to this. As you can well imagine, I've listened to every podcast that we have done, which is amazing. I have that chance. And I've thought about, where do I love to go? But still, one of my most favourite places is to go to the Yorkshire Dales. And so we're going to go to the Dales, and we're going to do a very specific walk. And we're going to start in a place called Malham. And the route takes you, it's a circular walk, so you end up back in the village. And we're going via Janet's Foss, which is a waterfall. And if you want to, you can go swimming in that waterfall, if that, you know, sort of floats your boat,
Is it heated? If it's not heated, I'm all right. I'll give it a miss. I'll leave it.
Yeah. So the other, I think it's November time, I was up there and like people were doing like cold water swimming and I'm like, no, you're right.
Yeah, not for me.
And then you just walk, you follow the route round and you come to a place called Gordel Scar, which is again another, but a huge waterfall, if particularly if it's rained heavy. And if you're fit enough, you can like walk up the side of the waterfall because it's quite a rocky sort of place to be. Or there's another route you can avoid that area to get at. You end up at a place called Malham Ton, which is just stunning, but you eventually end up at Malham Cove, which is this massive limestone escarpment, they'll call it. It is absolutely stunning. You need to go early in the morning because it can become a bit of a touristy busy place. But it's just a beautiful walk, and it reminds me of school, believe it or not. As a teenager, we used to go camping in that area, but with school. It was a school camp, and that's my first encounter with such stunning beauty. So I love it. It brings back lots of good memories for me. So that's where we're going.
Sounds absolutely beautiful. Now, who's coming with us? One living, one dead, one fictional. Who's on the walk?
Again, I could choose from a myriad of people for their living, to be quite honest. There's lots of people I would love to come on this walk. I'd love to. I know we're not allowed to change the rules, though I have heard other people change the rules.
I've heard it.
Sorry, but I know because obviously I'm apparently the boss.
Yes.
I have to stick to what we've agreed. This amazing production. So the person I'm going to take with me is actually a friend. I'm going to take my friend Ruth. And Ruth and I have been friends from teenage years.
Wow.
And we are still very, very good friends, very close friends. But it's that sort of friendship where you don't speak for 3 months, but when you do, you're just, together in this conversation. We've laughed together, we've cried together, we've prayed together, we've worshipped together, we've gone on walks together, we've just been together. And I just want Ruth to come. She's good fun, she loves the outdoors. She probably would prefer to go on a mountain bike than walk it, but she's got a real spirit of adventure. Mm. So yeah, I'm going to bring Ruth.
Amazing. Okay, so that's living. Who's our dead compatriot?
Okay, I'm going to go a bit old school Salvation Army. I know you might expect that with me being a Salvation Army officer. But I'm going to go for a character called George Scott Railton. So Railton was probably the third founder of the Salvation Army, people would say, after William and Catherine. But it's quite an eccentric character if to read his books. And I probably just like his story in some ways. Some bits are quite painful of his story. But the two things that resonate with me are Railton was the guy who started the Salvation Army in America. And he took his Hallelujah Lasses with him, which were in effect a bunch of teenagers. So he took these young people to start the work of the Salvation Army in America. And I just love the fact that even back then, in our history, we were just empowering teenagers to go and do something and to make a difference. So that obviously resonates with my youth and children's heart that I have. But also he was prepared to speak out and he was prepared to challenge. And there's a great story of him disagreeing with William Booth over some decisions that were being made. And there's one of these big like Congress type meetings. And at that point, the army were launching this Assurance Society. And Railton completely disagreed. And so he chose to sit on the platform at this huge gathering in sackcloth and ashes to show his disapproval of what where the Salvation Army was going. And obviously that didn't go well with the founder, you can imagine, because he was a bit of an autocrat. But it was just he was prepared to challenge and speak out. And some people viewed him as the St. Francis of the Salvation Army, really. So, bit of a different character, interesting stories.
And then your fictional character, who's coming with us?
Okay, I've ummed and ahed about this. I'm not big on fiction in some ways. Some people will come back with you with all sorts of people. So I'm going to go for, I think, Simba at The Lion King.
Old or young?
We're going for old Simba because the young one might have been a little bit irritating.
You heard it from the Territorial Youth and Children's Secretary first.
Yeah, yeah, Helen said that. Okay. But I think it's more about the journey that Simba went on. Because actually he went his own hypothetical journey, didn't he? And he had to come back and face up to the issues that he was going with. So I've gone for Simba. I nearly went for Aslan, but I've decided let's have a bit of Disney going on. And we'll stick with Simba. So, and he wasn't that old, was he, when he sort of, you know, faced up to his issues. I would say he's still a teenager.
I think
really. You're
right. I think if you look at the timeline, I think you're right. I think he probably is kind of a sort of a mid to late teenager at that point, isn't he? There's still that kind of, yeah, that probably adds up in the timeline. I've never really looked into how long it actually is. But yeah, you must be right. It can't be, you know, it's not 30 years. It's a different timeline. It's shorter, isn't it? So that's really interesting. I love it. I love that we're taking kind of your best friend, a kind of a Salvation Army historical character, and a lion. I think it's going to be quite the war.
And you're coming, aren't you?
Well, I was until the lion turned up, and now I'm not so sure. I might do this one on Zoom.
Coward.
It's going to be a lot of fun, this one. I'm very excited about this. Now, listen, all the guests on the Ultra Rim podcast answer the same four questions. And the first one is this. How do we face change?
Okay. You've had many answers for this, obviously, this being the 30th something episode. I'd like to say I face change with great enthusiasm, but I'm not sure that's true. I think it used to be if it was a change in something happening or something exciting's happening, then probably at that point, I was like, oh, yeah, it's really good. It's very exciting. But I have found when it becomes the personal change, the older I've got, the more I'm not sure about change, and I'm not sure about, well, I'm sure about how I'd face change, but I'd probably process it for differently to when I was a lot younger, if I'm really honest with you. For me, I probably handle change. If I have a choice in it, I handle it differently. If I have a conversation around it, I can't abide being done to. Big thing for me, I want to be part of the dialogue. As an individual, I'm a bit of a why person. I want to know. Tell me why that decision has been made. Tell me, you know, I'm probably a bit of a, still got the toddler in me, because I just want to understand a little bit. Because I want to be part of shaping decisions. Really is the big thing for me, and that doesn't always work well when you're a Salvation Army officer, does it? Because you don't get to pick your appointment. Your appointment is given to you, so I have to go through quite a process of thinking that through. I always come to the point, particularly around officership, it's an act of obedience. I knew that when I signed up. I think there could be quite a purity in the appointments process. And some people are probably, they're hearing this and shouting at me. But I think if we as the individual just keep allowing God to shape us and to take hold of what's been given us. And he might not think that's the best appointment, but actually helps us to deal with it and to change our heart, our attitude around that.
So for some people listening who maybe aren't across how Salvation Army officership, which is full-time kind of Christian ministry within the Salvation Army, in a particular way, our kind of version of ordination. You'll get emails about the way I'm describing this, but I'm trying to do my best for people who maybe sit outside of the Salvation Army world. If we imagine Salvation Army officers as the Salvation Army's ordained ministers, in a way, what is quite different to other denominations and other ways of doing it is that in the Salvation Army, you don't necessarily get a choice in where you go. You don't apply for an open position, but effectively people are moved around. Now, that's changed over the decades, back in the early days, even through to the, you know, can we say 90s, maybe even a bit later. It was a bit of a kind of a, there was a certain date and you got a letter and you got told this is where you're going. You've already said there's a bit more consultation now, but ultimately, I guess there isn't a huge amount of choice. Is that fair? Am I being fair when I say that? Because I don't want to mischaracterize it. So for people then listening, you know, they've heard you say you're someone who for your whole life has always wanted to have a say in the decision. And yet you enter into this covenant with the Salvation Army, which ultimately removes a huge amount of choice from your life in terms of where you live, what your specific role is, how long you get to stay there for. All of those things are taken. So talk me through how much of a battle that was in terms of going from, I think there's something about Salvation Army officership that I'm being asked to step into, and but there's also this huge part of my character that wants and longs and needs to be part of decision making, especially when it impacts me.
Yeah, I think in the early days when I applied for officership, I probably had this quite, my view was I'd always be a corps officer.
Mm.
So, and because that was, in some ways, I felt very convicted of to go into officership. You never go into this from on a whim. It was very much a God thing. And so I felt, but my perception of officership was corps officership.
Mm.
I'd be a corps officer. And probably because I understood that world, I knew about it, that was okay. Because even, and you're thinking, I entered college in 1999, and then there were different corps, and I was privileged to come from a corps that was quite modern, it's moving forward, it's Nottingham Arnold, it's, you know, it's a good place to be part of. I suppose because I understood the parameters of corps officership, I probably dealt with it quite well. But actually, I've had a different appointment every time I've been moved now. And so for a lot of people, they would have a consultation nearly a year beforehand now. They would go through this whole process, whereas mine's been quite different.
Mm.
And so it becomes back. I've had to lay down, some of that, the grappling, because actually it's exhausting when you can constantly battle.
Mm.
And so I will ask the question. So if an appointment's given, help me to understand that, or help, particularly if I don't see it.
Yeah.
So it's more me ensuring I try and have the right conversations, even after the appointment's been given. How do you see that working out? I see my role in this, like this appointment, because it's so different from what had gone before. In terms of even the role, I asked a lot of questions to help me in that process.
I think that's really interesting, because I guess what I'm hearing you say is that even when a change is being put on you, and I'm not trying to be a motive for that language, but even when a change is kind of given to you, you almost kind of grab the agency back. It's like, I may not be able to change the outcome of this. I may not be able to stop or divert where this is going, but you still have an opportunity to go, but I need to know more. And it's almost like you get your agency back by stepping in and asking the why question.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, so it becomes, but it helps me to own it as well. It helps me to and not feel it's just, you know, I use the phrase done to sort
yeah,
of thing.
Yeah.
But I want to own it. I want to understand it. And so I don't know, for some people, it could be quite irritating that I ask lots of questions normally, you know. But for me, it's just, it helps me to process and own.
As a leader then, do you find it irritating when people give you the why questions, or does it make you more open to that?
No, it makes me open to it. And I want to, my team, they'd have to confirm this, but for me, I try and bring them into the conversation.
Mm.
So it's really important for me to empower people in my team, for them to make decisions, but also to help to shape what's going on within whatever we're doing. So, yeah, I want to hear from them. To me, it's really important that they can ask why. Can we process this together? Can we talk about this some more? But probably in the sharing of ownership, I don't get so many why questions.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And it's only probably when I'm having to deliver information that I've been given from leadership that I've not decided.
Yeah.
But I am passing on. I have to pass on information.
Yeah.
That's when it's the hardest space. You're sat between those two places, aren't you? Where it's like, how do I stay loyal to my leadership?
Yeah.
How do I stay loyal to team?
Yeah.
And answer well and support both well.
It's interesting. I think over the last few episodes, we've heard people who have been in leadership for many years, like yourself. It's been fascinating for me to hear people reflect back and realize that some of their own personality traits, and sometimes even personality traits, you know, you've said yourself that kind of constant questioning can be irritating for other people, but actually to understand how to harness something in your character and then reflect it and turn it into a positive for what you do, I think that's been really helpful over the last number of episodes to hear people do that, because I think all of us go, there's this bit of us or this bit of our character that has maybe always felt like it's a bit irritating or something that we wanted to dial down, but actually when you reflect on it properly, it can become such a great and brilliant tool to help us actually be better by kind of harnessing it in a different way. I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, and it's only as you talk and reflect, isn't it, that you start to realise, totally. Oh, actually, that is what I do.
Totally.
Yeah.
No, the second question that everyone answers is this one. How do we move through suffering?
Okay, for me, I've always loved the word, how it's phrased, move through suffering. Okay, that's been a very important thing. When I hear that, we don't just stay in that suffering, do we? Though there's probably times in my own life, and there's times in other people's lives, and you think of some of the horrific stuff that's happening at the moment, where they feel probably quite stuck in that space. But we normally move through it. So that's a good, it always reminds me that's just so important. So when I look back on my own life, and age is a great thing, isn't it? Let's be quite frank. We have a lot to reflect on. I could say there's been a number of times when probably life's been quite tough, to be honest. So when I was 21, I don't know if you even know this story, Matt, but anyway, I was nearing the end of nurse training. I'd done 3 years. I probably had 5 weeks to go. 2 final exams and qualified. I had my life planned out. Okay. So I was doing nurse training. I was going to practice for a while, get some money. I felt from a young age that God had called me to officership. And after only a little bit of a struggle, I was going to move forward into that. And so it was all planned. But then I went and really badly damaged my back. And so I was in bed. I turned and my spine actually locked. Okay. It's a freak. Everyone said it was a freak accident. It was a freak accident. I was paralyzed down one side, so I couldn't move. I was locked in a nurse's home in my room, as it was, but thankfully I got out and stayed to hospital, and the movement came back a bit later. But to cut what was a very long story shorter, I actually spent 8 years in and out of hospital. And I had 5 major operations, spinal operations. They all failed. I had lots of minor treatments. They failed. And eventually the consultant said, there's nothing else we can do for you. You have to live with the pain. And there's a slight glimmer you might improve. So that's quite a big thing. It's in my 20s. It was huge. So I always think it's funny when we use the word suffering. It all sounds quite traumatic for me. But actually, there was a lot of suffering, as you can imagine, during that time, both physically, emotionally, and spiritually. So I lost 2 careers. I felt I lost 2 careers. I lost nursing. I couldn't move forward into officership. So how did I move through that time, journey through that time? Again, I'd love to say to you, it was all very smooth. And you know, that'd be a big fat lie. But it was a complete mixture of emotion. I move through that sometimes just by sheer determination. I'm quite stubborn at times. Sometimes that's a holy stubbornness, I believe, given of God. Sometimes it's just me, quite frankly, and my personality. But the stubbornness, you know, at one point helped me after a real major operation to, in effect, learn to walk again. I wasn't in a wheelchair, but I had to get mobile again. And so I set myself these goals, I had my crutches, and I was aiming for a lamppost a day. But it was sheer stubbornness. I could have wallowed in my pain, but I was like, no way. And so my stubbornness, I took hold of a character trait again, and that helped with that. I remember times spiritually, I was hanging on. I remember my CEO saying it's like a Gethsemane type experience, but I felt quite abandoned by God, at times by others. Those times I shouted at God, the times I cried, times I was just silent. But there were other times in those 8 years that my spiritual life was strong. I look back on prayer journals that I kept, and it was like, it was a real deep connection to God. And I remember just being, feeding on his word and just sort of, you know, just really engaging with him. I could go on and on. I suppose some of it is, you know, you think back to change, isn't it? And in change, we sometimes don't see God's presence, but we know God is present when we're dealing with change. But actually, it was those moments when I didn't sense God, I still had dug deep to know that he was there. I believed that he was there. I think I worked through that time, because it was the importance of actually telling God how I felt. It was real. I had to be real. there's no point going, yeah, I'm fine, which is our pat answer. I have to be really real with God and shout, cry, rant with that, deal with the doubt. Doubt's really important. That was my life for 8 years. But it was in the mess that somehow or other I knew God was with me.
Yeah. I think I've told the story before on the podcast, but I can never remember what I say on the when we do it and then what I actually leave in. But my son came to me about a year ago after a dear friend of ours had lost his life and had a child around the same age as my son. And he came to me and he said, Daddy, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to do this. And I might be in trouble here, but I've just been upstairs really telling God off because everything's just not fair. And I remember sitting with him and I said, no, it is okay. And literally grabbed one of his Bibles and grabbed one of my Bibles and we looked at some of the Psalms. I said, look, the Bible's full of it. Like, it's full of this stuff. It's literally in there. I guess my question to you is, in those moments when you were so aware of God's presence, but you were also so angry and so kind of like telling God off in that sense, how did you feel in that moment? Was God okay with it with you in that moment? Or did you almost have the feeling of my son of, I'm not sure if I should be doing this, but this is just how I feel. Where were you at?
No, I think I was comfortable in doing it. I think it was okay. It was fine to do that. And I think it's that thing of, it's the relational piece again, isn't it? Yes. Of, we experienced that depth relationship for me. I became a Christian at 14. It was a life-changing moment. It wasn't a slow journey. So I'd experienced a depth of relationship at that time. And it was okay to shout and rant or not talk, but still know somehow he was there.
Yeah.
I don't remember having guilt about it.
Yeah.
I just remember, well, sick, you've got it. You get it all.
But that's so important, isn't it? Because I think that's the challenge that many people face, isn't it? It's like a child. We go, everything within me says, I want to tell you exactly how I feel. And there's a confidence in going to God and telling God how you feel. But then for so many of us, there is this sense of, oh no, what have I done? I wasn't meant to do that. I wasn't allowed to do that. And so it feels like you're right, that by cultivating that depth of relationship with God, it wasn't like you were shouting into the void. You were able to have that honest rant, that honest outpouring of your suffering, and know that God was so deeply present still in that moment. I think that's so healthy. That sounds so healthy.
Yeah, and I suppose it's, again, as we talk about it, you know, it's some time ago, it is that God was present, and that was present, even though I didn't always feel that. And you just get in it. And I was probably so broken at times. When I think back to that time, that's all I could do. Do you know what I mean? That it was all, you just had to had the brokenness and the tears and the shouting.
Yeah.
Because I was in my 20s and my life was before me, and I then couldn't see anything before me. Because, you know, particularly when the surgeon finally went, we can't do anything for you. Yeah, it's a tough time.
As you reflect on it now, what are the lessons from that time that you still carry, do you think, through into your life now and you still walk in daily?
Lots of things, really. It is, even in the darkest moment, God is there. Okay, even though I can't see him, and there's been other things since that time where I've had to really put that to the test. You know, the dark night, the soul type experiences, but just I look back and know, because of that dark time there, when stuff happens now, as has happened since, that God is present. And hope, and I'm passionate about hope. God saw me through that time and continues, and when other stuff has come up and will come up, it's that understanding that God is with me. God is with us in that. So that becomes like, I look back to God's faithfulness. And when you're first going through stuff and you've not dealt with stuff before, it's really hard. What do you look back to? But, you know, I look back and know that God was faithful in that space. And it probably shapes the way I view other people when they're suffering. It does. Completely shapes my view, particularly long-term pain, long-term illness, you know, how people are in that context. And probably my empathy or probably my empathy is shaped by what happened. I know I can't stand in their shoes, but I have a little bit of an inkling to understand long-term suffering or long-term pain, illness, sort of thing. But it's very much that it's the faithfulness of God in all things, that he was there then, he's there now.
No, you talked about then the surgeon. So the surgeon says there's nothing more you can do. Obviously, you talked about walking to lamppost. What happens next? How do we get to now?
So in effect, once they stopped all the treatments and interventions, and I do believe God was very much involved with this, but slowly but surely, the pain started to diminish.
Wow.
And I got to the point where I was far more active. Yeah. I slowly increased my activity and all that I was doing. So it's very rare now that people will know that I've had a bad back, that I move things. If I'm exceptionally tired, I walk with a limp. Mm. That would be the only indicator that I had all this trauma, really. I remember talking to Chris Pierce. You know Chris Pierce. And she was like, well, it's a miracle, Helen. And at that point, I never really equated it as a miracle. But actually, I do believe it's a God intervention. I do believe God was part of that. And slowly but surely, my pain diminished, my mobility got better. And that's it.
Wow.
So I'm just left with a few scars and the occasional limp. And on the odd occasion, it will go into muscle spasm.
Yeah.
It's very, very, so probably 4 times in the past 20 years.
Wow.
So.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. I mean, I could probably talk to you more about all of those things for another 4 hours, but we do have to keep going on our hypothetical hike. So the third choice you have to make along the way is our playlist. So what's going to be on that playlist on the walk?
Right, Matt, obviously, again, I've listened to so many people share their amazing music with you, and you normally bring in a bit of affirmation around this.
Always.
Yeah, I probably have the most eclectic playlist going.
Okay.
Okay, so it will range. If you were to do shuffle on my, you know, on my phone, it will range from a Salvation Army songs to piece, a brass band piece, to Queen, Carpenters, ABBA, Adele, even a Gilbert and Sullivan comic opera, The Mikado.
Oh, interesting.
To crazy Disney music, to see Hillsong, Bethel.
Yeah.
Elevation, anybody you can name is, well, not everyone, quite frankly, but it's so, so different. So because we're taking Simba with us, I'm guessing we should have some of the theme music from The Lion King going on as well.
Yeah, a bit of that.
Hans Zimmer and all the rest of it.
I like that. I like the idea that he can sing his parts and we can sort of fill in all the others along the way, right? Just play all the other characters.
Right, yeah, that wasn't the idea.
I was thinking we get to that waterfall, right? And then we can do all the kind of that we can do Just Can't Wait to Be King. We can do Hakuna Matata. Can You Feel the Love? We could get them all going.
We could get them all going.
I'll try and lift them for Circle of Life. Like, do a whole, he'll hit that. But give it the whole thing. Give it the whole, I think that could be great fun. That sounds excellent. Lovely.
It could be. But so very eclectic, very different.
Oh, I love it. Sounds great.
Yeah.
Okay, so question 3 is this. How do we receive joy?
Well, again, spoken about by lots of people, obviously. For me, it's a choice.
Mm.
We have to choose to receive joy. I think it's really important. And we have to at times make that deliberate decision to look for joy.
Mm.
So it's all around the whole gratitude thing. What am I grateful for? At the beginning of 2020, I started a gratitude journal. So lockdown was nowhere near, and that obviously was within 2 months. Mm. And actually just that whole reflecting on each day, writing down what I was grateful for.
Yeah.
And I never, when I started that, I never realized how important it would become over the past 2 years. By being grateful, I believe it brings joy into our lives, if that makes any sense. So yeah, it was very much every day for nearly 2 years I've written in that journal of what I'm grateful for. And you can imagine, I already probably said I'm quite a people person. Mm. So in lockdown, living alone, not being able to see people, I had to really dig deep into what am I joyful about, because this could, and it was hard going, but it's trying to keep on top of no, I'm going to stay in a good place. I can't go under. And having that attitude of gratitude, really, which you've heard lots about, but actually it really helped me. It really helped me and changed my perspective. And there were times when I think about the past 2 years, particularly the pandemic stuff and a lot of the stuff that happened, it was really tough to sit down every night and go, what am I grateful for? You know, there's some work issues that were really painful that we had to deal with. And I had to really just focus, actually, what am I grateful for? And that, I think, created in me this sense of joy. I also know at the beginning of this year, God laid on me that I had to pay attention. And I felt like it gave me, people talk about what's my words for the year. I don't normally do that, but I just felt, it was a bit of a God prompt to pay attention this year. But again, paying attention to what I was seeing as going out to creation.
Yeah.
When I was with people, what am I hearing?
Yeah.
Even the simple smile.
Yeah.
What wasn't the smile? What's on their hearts? Yeah. Paying attention to that. And it's really important.
Let's talk about the gratitude journal, because I know a few people who've tried that exercise, that kind of discipline of keeping something like that. I mean, we've known each other for, like we said, maybe 15 years. I would never have classed you as an ungrateful person. But in the last 2 years, would you say that you have seen a marked difference in terms of just your entire outlook and attitude because of that? And it is a discipline, right? The practice and discipline of recording gratitude every day. Can you see that kind of tangible difference in yourself?
Yes, because I think I've been more intentional with doing it. So when we were allowed out for a walk for an hour or whatever it was, back, you know, in those early times, it was, I'm looking, my eyes were looking for actually, you know, the spring in 2020 was stunning.
Yeah.
And I was like trying to ensure that I looked for those things. So it's the intentionality around it for me. Whereas I would say most of the time I am quite grateful. I am grateful. I feel very blessed. I feel, you know, humbled, but I would say that is my outlook, but it just felt there's an intentionality to it. Looking up, being aware, and perhaps it was something about, what am I going to write in my journal today? Well, I don't know.
That was my next question. Cause my next question was, well, it was twofold really. Was one was, did you ever get to the point of doing the journaling and go, nope, I can't think of anything, I've done it. But or similarly, when you were out and about, were you ever thinking, oh, I still haven't found anything today for my journal? Because I like the intentionality of that. But was that something that happened along the way?
I think I remember once when it had been a particularly real painful work day. And I remember sitting down and going, what am I going to write here? And I had to like replay the day. And I'll laugh now, and I've shared this before in another space, but I even wrote, God, I'm grateful for mashed potato. I didn't make mashed potato very often. But it was that there's got to be something in this day. And I think also I've always had that mindset that I'm grateful I can turn on the tap, Matt, and drink the water. I've always, that's been, not always, but that's been part of my life for many years. I can, you know, unless there's a major power outage, I can turn on the lights. I've got food in my cupboard and I've got beautiful friends. So it becomes some of those going back to actually the basics of life.
Real gratitude stops us taking things for granted, right? It's one of my favorite scenes from The Simpsons is they have Reverend Lovejoy round and they ask Bart to do the grace. And he says, dear Lord, we paid for all this food for ourselves, so thanks for nothing. And yet there's something so human and real about that instinct, which I can see in myself at times, right? That thing of, well, I did this. I worked hard for this. And even in starting to take things for granted, like running water, electricity, the food in the cupboard, all those things that we can so easily take for granted. And gratitude stops us doing that. Because when we're almost forced to write, thanks God for mashed potatoes, we're reminded of that we're not an island, right? We're not kind of self-sufficient in the way we perhaps pride ourselves on being. There's something about being grateful that really helps us in that.
Very much so.
I think that's a really interesting thing that you've done. And again, it's a practice I'm sure many people would really enjoy. Did you buy like a specific gratitude journal? Was there something you went and found, or did you just start doing it yourself in a notebook? Just got a notebook and...
Notebooks. So I filled a few notebooks.
That's amazing.
And just started writing it. And interestingly, I sort of stopped just before Christmas But I've restarted again because that end of day focus and reflection moment is actually, I find it a real good spiritual discipline.
Yeah.
It's just a good just moment just to look back. Actually, yeah, God, what am I grateful for? What's been going on?
Yeah.
In my life. And yeah.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. One more question, but first one more choice. And the choice is this. What's in the snack bag? I'm guessing mashed potato. I'm guessing that's where it's ever.
No, you don't really take mashed potato on a hike, do you, Matt? Have you done much hiking? Well, I can assure you it's not like some health bean good. Or anything like that, because you've had some weird food mixes. Awful. In this, these choices. So I've been a bit stunned. So mine's very, very basic.
Okay.
Okay. So it's going to be ham sandwiches.
Okay.
Okay. So I'll get more than one thing, don't I?
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's a whole bag. It's a bag of whatever you want. Fill it.
Okay, ham sandwiches, but they've got to be on like thick, chunky bread, like good. You know, the bread you chop yourself.
Yes.
But with butter, okay?
Good.
All highly unhealthy, that's... but it's something about a chunky sandwich.
Yeah.
Okay, ready salted crisps, okay?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I know you're struggling with that.
Well,
anyway.
I am. Okay, do you know why? Because my in-laws only buy ready salted crisps, and I always give them a hard time about it, because essentially you're buying crisp-flavoured crisps. Like, of all the things in the world you can choose, you chose to get the one that just is the thing. Crisp flavored crisps.
Which is quite good. It's simple. It's practical.
Sure.
It's nice. Okay.
All right.
Right. Okay. The third thing is a chunk of like proper fruitcake.
Oh. Right.
You know, real like solid fruitcake.
Yeah.
Okay. So we'll have that. And obviously dairy, milk, chocolate. They are the snack. Oh, one more thing. One more thing. Very important. A flask of decent coffee, obviously.
That, I mean, that goes without saying. You know, that's the only thing I'm bringing. I mean, literally, I'll forget my boots, but I'll have coffee filters. We've got one more question, one final question for this episode, and that is, how do you mature in service?
Okay, so very much about getting involved, getting your hands dirty. Mm. I think for me, the experiences I've had, it's been... And probably from a young age, just getting involved in service, because that helps to shape you. It helps to helps you to mature, really. So I went to a small Salvation Army corps there, and I was like working in primary at the age of 14. Mm. And I was like looking after the junior soldiers, like some of the young people at 16. So I was involved in that sort of service type thing from a very young age. But it shaped and it developed me. And obviously, as the years have gone on, getting involved, getting alongside people, going on their journey with them helps me to mature in service. And I could tell many stories. Like Bristol was such a varied place in the people I encountered. So the estate on Knoll West, getting involved in people's lives who are actually suffering from really extreme poverty, and just going on the journey with them, sitting with them, and just listening to them at times. And just being with them, which is so utterly important. Being in community with those guys shaped me, helped me to develop. And my own upbringing was on a council estate, you know, and I look back now and it was okay. I remember my mum fighting with the local council to get our house remodernised because actually the paper was just falling off the walls.
Yeah.
But as a child, you don't really realise, actually, that's a bit grim.
Yeah.
But bless her, she did, and the houses got remodernised. And but I understood some of that council estate living. I don't think our estate was quite as poor as the estate that Knoll West was. But it's that sitting with people, being with them, helps me to mature in service.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to gain that understanding around other people and what they're about. I think also what helps us to mature in service and what's helped me mature in service, I've had a huge privilege to be able to travel overseas. My very good friends that you know, Richard and Heidi Bradbury, beautiful, beautiful, godly people. And through our friendship, I've managed to go and visit them, both in Zambia and then in Kenya and then in Bangladesh. And it's always been amazing to see them, to be with them and their family. They're good people. To see them in action, in their care of their communities that they're involved with, the people that they loved. But also, I was shaped not only by their influence, but by the influence of the local community, the local people, and the way that they served others.
Yeah.
And also, one of the things that always was challenged me, it was the first time I went to Zambia, was, again, people who live in extreme poverty, but their generosity.
Yeah.
To us, we took a team to Zambia, a team of young people.
Yeah.
That's when I was DY. And in people's extreme poverty in Zambia, how they wanted to serve you,
yeah,
and wanted to give to you, wanted to provide lunch for you. And it was just mind-blowing. I can't really describe it.
Yeah.
So they were giving generously out of their poverty. And I had the chance to go to some, I'm going to say amazing places, but actually in terms of what the deprivation that you saw. So I went to Kibera. I've been to Kibera 2-3 times. And Kibera is probably, I think it's listed as the biggest slum probably in the continent of Africa, or one of them. And it's hard to describe Kibera unless you've looked it up, unless you've been there, unless you've took time to I don't know, it's been on a TV program, or you've looked on Google or whatever. But it's these shacks, but thousands and thousands and thousands of shacks, all just pushed together with no proper running water. You're just living in this tin hut. It's filth, the squalor. There's a toilet block that serves thousands, and people joke about flying toilets. Mm. But in effect, people use a bag to go to the toilet and they throw it sort of thing. And it's just hard to imagine. But again, seeing people serve in that context, local people serving each other.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that helps, that helped me, that really shaped me maturing in service too.
Yeah.
You know, going to Bangladesh and going into the brothel with one of the local officers and seeing how this woman just loved the girls, cared for the girls, and they loved her.
Yeah.
And it was profound.
Yeah.
And it shapes you, doesn't it? It challenges you
and
helps you to mature. As well, I think another thing that I've had to deal with at different points in my life is actually, how do we allow others to serve us? Have I allowed others to serve me? So I'm as you probably know, Matt, I'm quite independent.
Yeah.
get on with stuff. I'm fine. I can sort this, etc. But there's been moments in my life when I've had to learn the lesson that not only is it great to give out grace, but actually I need to pause and receive it.
Yeah.
And receive the service of others and allow myself to be vulnerable enough to do that.
Yes.
And because perhaps it's something about, you know, normally living alone, normally the independence thing comes, doesn't it? You've got to get on with stuff. But the power of allowing someone else to serve you,
it
shapes you.
Yes.
And I've had to learn this at very different points. So even when all those years ago when I was nursing and then I had to go into the hospital that I worked in, I had to, allow my colleagues to actually physically care for me. But at different points in my life, I've had to go through this process of, it's okay. Others want to serve you. Others want to love you. And you have to, make yourself vulnerable for that to happen.
I think that's huge, because I think for so many of us, we have found ourselves in a position where, you know, you talked about it, you know, if we grew up in the Salvation Army very young, and this was a hugely positive experience for me, but being used to kind of doing things and that being a mark of almost maturity, right? Maturity came because you were asked to serve. And actually, as I've got older, realizing that actually immaturity is the thing that stops me allowing others to serve me. It's like a deep sense of immaturity that says, no, I can't, I don't want to be served. I'm the one who serves others. I'm the one who does that. And I guess one of my questions, because you know, we've talked about this a lot over the years, but I guess there's a challenge, isn't there? Particularly when we work with children and young people, but in any setting of almost service becoming participation, just doing something, like giving someone a job so they feel valued. And that can undoubtedly work, but real mature service is a bit more than that, isn't it? There's another level, another layer, another depth. And I think what you've touched upon there is right. It's that thing of almost how do we serve without not being served becoming part of our identity package. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it just makes sense. And I think I think sometimes we can, as you say, as we've grown up, we've been given things to do.
Yeah.
But sometimes young people just want people to be with them as well.
Yes.
But they just want to be in a journey with you. They want to just walk along. They want to walk alongside you just as much as an adult walks alongside them. And so it's probably learning, there's a few things in all this, isn't there? It's learning as adults that to enable young people, you don't just need to give them a job.
Yes.
Sometimes the job's really good for them and it helps them. But sometimes it is just actually in the relational piece.
Yes.
That we mature. It's in the conversation piece. It's in the coming alongside piece. Does that make sense?
I think it does. And I think it sort of ties into what you've said about, it's Shia says it, doesn't he? I've got the quote here, but he says, "We have come to understand that genuine service, like real relationships, must move in two directions." And that's what you're talking about, right? That service isn't the job you do. Service isn't just, you know, being in that place or quote unquote looking after or doing the job. Service has to be a two-way street, which means it has to be relational. Otherwise, like you say, it's just giving someone something to do, or it's helping someone feel the kind of the ego boost in the best possible way of being needed or wanted. But actually, when we then don't allow other people to serve us, then actually what we do is we actually do more harm. So it's all well and good going, I'm going to give you a job, you go over there. But then if we don't allow that person to also serve us in return, it's why, and it gets talked about, I don't know how many times over these 30 odd episodes, but the washing of feet is so important. And the instinct then to go, no way, you're not washing my feet, is so like a warning sign, right? That story carries so much deep warning to all of us. It's all well and good to want to be a disciple. It's all well and good to want to serve. But unless you are willing to be served, then you're probably only halfway there and you're probably never going to hit that maturity that we all want for ourselves and for everyone, right?
Yeah, very much so. And it is a sense of you've just got to lay down yourself, haven't you? You've got to lay down your wants, your desires, your independence, etc.
Yeah.
But actually allow others to serve you. And it is it's a beautiful thing when it happens to you, it shapes you, it changes you, doesn't it?
It is. And it's the ultimate surrender, because for so many of us, Andrew Grinnell and I talked about this in our episode, but the idea that we kind of we lay everything down so that we can get active is the myth. The real act of surrender is surrendering all of that, including the identity that comes in, I've laid everything down to serve. Like the real act of surrender comes in going, I now step into this relationship. This is a two-way relationship. This is something in which I give and receive. That is the ultimate act of surrender. And that probably is the surest sign of maturing in service, I'd say.
Yeah. And I think with young people, you know, we always think we've got the answers, don't we? We've got the, you know, we'll do to them, etc. But actually, it's about, no, we've got to allow them to serve us and to journey with us in that relational piece, that, you know, sense that God is in that relationship, isn't it?
Definitely.
And I don't know, when we sort of go into community, we don't have the answers.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have the answers in these situations. And again, it's that whole just being with people and allowing them to serve and work in their context.
Yeah. Wonderful. Helen, that's it. That's the last question. I want to say a massive thank you for coming on to the show. Like I said at the start, I've been looking forward to this recording for a very long time because it's been great. But also, it's great to have you on because this is actually going to be my last episode as the host of the Altering Podcast. I am moving on, but the show is coming back next year. So again, it's great to have you on here to kind of be my last ever guest here on the Altering Podcast.
Thanks, Matt. It's a privilege to be on the podcast. And thank you, obviously. It's been great to be part of it. But I want to thank you for all that you've given to this podcast. I want to thank you for your beautiful way you can bring out of people the right thing, okay, and all that you've contributed. As I've said before, I've listened to all of them, and I've been challenged, Matt, just by the way, quite seriously. You just shape a conversation. You have a depth of insight that I think is really profound. And you've enriched this podcast. So thank you for all the work that you've done. Thank you for what you've given of yourself. the way that you've served others in this podcast, it's been a rich blessing, and just completely appreciate all you've done.
It's been amazing. It's been a huge privilege to be part of it. I'll say a bit when we finish here as well, and because I've got loads of people I want to thank. But genuinely, to you, Alan, thanks for taking the chance on this project, and for you and the team to get behind something like this, and to give it all the support you have and are going to continue to give it. I just think is really brilliant, and it has been genuinely, you know, one of the best things I get to do, because I just love talking to people, and I love hearing people's stories, and I love hearing you know, people share what they've done, and we've had so much fun along the way over the last 3 years making this one. So yeah, huge thanks to you.
No, it's great. Thank you.
And thanks for being on this, my last episode. What an absolutely brilliant final guest for me to get to speak to. It's been absolutely brilliant. I've really, really loved it. Thank you.
Thanks, Matt.
Well, another huge thank you to Helen for joining me today on the podcast. And that's it, not just for this episode, but for me as host of the All Terrain podcast. It's been a tremendous 3 years. I've had a brilliant time, and I just want to take a couple of seconds just to say some really big thank yous. Firstly, to Alexander John Shire for allowing us to use his teaching, Quadratos, Heart and Mind, the book, to allow us to use those questions as the basis of this hypothetical hike. We don't take that for granted. And also for not only appearing on the podcast three times, I think it was, but also for his encouragement and support behind the scenes as well. It really has meant the world to us. I also want to say thank you to Helen and Phil and the Youth and Children's Ministry Unit. You guys have just been incredible. Your support for this project and giving me the opportunity to host it and to make the show, I've just been tremendously grateful for, and thank you so much. To every guest that has appeared, from the bottom of my heart, a very sincere thank you. I do not take for granted anyone giving up the time to come and share their story and to answer these questions with me. We have heard so many stories of people's lives. We've received so much wisdom from people. It has been honestly a pleasure to sit down every time and record these episodes. And finally, a huge thank you to you for listening. And not just listening, but for everyone who's shared it on their social media or written a post or got in touch with me privately to encourage me or share what they took from the conversation or to ask more questions. I have received every single one of those with so much gratitude. It really has been a pleasure to be part of this whole project. And I'm really excited for what comes next, because that is it for this series. I'd encourage you to go back over the summer, maybe listen to some of the old ones, go back and reacquaint yourself with some of those early episodes. Don't forget, show notes and sketch notes are available. The link is in the show description below to Matt Little and to Ian May, who are responsible for those every month. Wow, what an incredible resource those are. They are just phenomenal. I encourage you to check those out if you haven't already. You're really missing out if you don't get the whole kind of all-terrain podcast experience all together. And the all-terrain podcast will return for another series with more guests answering the same four questions and making the same four choices, but with a brand new host. And I, for one, cannot wait to listen as a fan of the show. But for now, it's my time to hang up my hypothetical hiking boots and say goodbye one last time from the All Terrain podcast.